Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour.
We're going to go to Vermont now. We're standing by as Garrett Graff, G-R-A-F-F. We're going to talk about you will die in a nuclear war, in all probability. But the American elite will survive. They'll be saved. We've had 60 years of planning for nuclear confrontation, and what this says about American democracy. Garrett Graff is a distinguished journalist and historian who focuses on politics, national security, and modern technology, especially the role of the Internet in politics. He is published in iWired, Esquire, Bloomberg. Earlier, he was the editor for two of Washington's main magazines, The Washingtonian and Politico. He was Howard Dean's webmaster when Dean served as governor of Vermont, and he's taught social media and digital journalism at Georgetown University. He's lectured at Harvard Business School and the National Press Club and on other campuses, and he is also involved with being on the board of the National Conference on Citizenship, a congressional chartered nonprofit founded by Truman and Eisenhower to support public engagement. And also he's on the board of Vermont Public Radio. So aside from his earlier book about the history of the FBI, his most recent book is Raven Rock, R-A-V-E-N, Rock, the story of the U.S. government's secret plan to save itself while the rest of us die, which details the 60-year history of the U.S. government's doomsday plan in the event of a nuclear war. His website is Garrett, G-A-R-R-E-T-T, Graff, G-R-A-F-F.com. Nice to have you with us today, Garrett.
My pleasure.
Garrett, I feel a good place to start is to describe the U.S. nuclear capability at present. We have all seen photos of different kinds of nuclear bombs, either dropped in Japan or tested in the Western Desert or in the Pacific Atolls or the Marshall Islands. And yet these incidences were over 50 years ago. And the technology of nuclear weapons has greatly advanced since then, and those older images are very likely a mere shadow of the kinds of bombs and their capacity for enormous devastation currently in our arsenal or that of compared to Nagasaki. We're probably speaking about something far more destructive and deadly today, and I think listeners need to understand that when that bomb called the Little Boy was dropped on Hiroshima, it leveled about a square mile of land. But today's bombs are exceedingly more powerful, so please begin by describing the destructive capacity of a modern nuclear warhead compared to the images of the nuclear detonations of the 40s and 50s, and because the truth behind the human environmental cost of nuclear war are not public, we don't know this. A newly elected president has no or little knowledge of the horror of a nuclear exchange until that person is informed of its magnitude or unless a new president is already among the elite. Trump, when he entered the White House, would have been clueless of a nuclear bomb's impact on American soil until he was educated on it. And I'm not sure how open to education on any issue he really is. So please also provide us an image of the extent to destruction and death that might occur during a nuclear exchange or nuclear strike on the United States in a worst-case scenario that the government plans for. The forum is yours. Take your time.
Thanks so much. That's a great set of questions, and you've got right to the heart of some of the biggest challenges facing this nuclear war planning. As you discuss, sort of the evolution of these plans as the book examines them from the Eisenhower years right up until the present day, is the evolution of an evolving technology revolution. And as these weapons have gotten stronger, as these weapons have gotten more numerous, and particularly as the technology around them and their launch and their destructive capability has grown and advanced as well. So for the last 50 years or so, the primary focus of our nuclear arsenal has been what's called the nuclear triad. And that's the three-legged stool of three different capabilities, each with their own strengths and their own destructive capability. So you have your nuclear-armed airplane bombers, you have your ICBMs, your intercontinental ballistic missiles, and then you have your submarines lurking around the globe with their own ICBMs and nuclear-tipped missiles. Now, as you say, you know, part of what is really lost in these conversations is just how powerful these weapons are compared to what people have any real familiarity with. And in fact, not just nuclear weapons have advanced, but conventional weapons have advanced as well. The mother of all bombs, the MOAB, that Donald Trump's commanders dropped in Afghanistan just a couple of weeks ago, that bomb, the largest conventional weapon in America's arsenal, is actually effectively the same size in explosive power as the bombs that were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So even a conventional bomb today can approach what we used to think of as a nuclear-only level. So nuclear bombs today, and particularly thermonuclear bombs, the hydrogen bombs that, based on physics, have no actual upward bound in their explosive capability. The average American weapon today is, you know, 100 to 200 times as powerful as a Nagasaki or Hiroshima bomb, and, you know, could be as powerful as 1,000 times as powerful as one of those bombs that we remember from World War II. Now, as you say, this is an area that is still very much lost to modern war planning. And one of the things that really fascinated me over the course of this book was thinking about and understanding the extent to which controlling this vast, massive arsenal shaped and changed the presidency over the course of the Cold War. And that in many ways, what we think of today as the majestic imperial U.S. presidency is actually a very fancy communications apparatus to ensure that wherever the president is, at any given time, anywhere in the world, he has access to and can launch our nuclear weapons. And we sort of forget about that in the context of looking at Air Force One or Marine One, but then it sort of pops up every so often, as it did this winter when that guest at Mar-a-Lago put on a big smile and snapped a selfie with the military aide who carries the nuclear football, the black briefcase that follows the president wherever he goes and contains all of the information necessary to launch a nuclear attack. And that many of these technologies, including Air Force One and Marine One, were really first introduced as ways to help ensure that the president could be evacuated safely and remain in communication with the nuclear arsenal wherever he goes. This, even today, no matter what's going on in the world, all of these tools are still available at the president's fingertips. And in fact, even today, as we are speaking right now, there is a 747 known as the E-4B Night Watch plane that's colloquially known as the President's Doomsday Plane, a nuclear airborne command center that is sitting on a runway at Offutt Air Force Base in Omaha, Nebraska, with its engines on and several dozen battle staff sitting right there ready to launch on 15 minutes notice and evacuate the president from wherever he is and spend 3 days circling the planet from 45,000 feet while the president can run a nuclear war right from his seat on the doomsday plane.
Since the advent of the nuclear bomb and entry into the Cold War with the Soviet Union and later China, the U.S. government has been preparing for doomsday possible scenarios in the event of a nuclear war. And this has required enormous hidden secret facilities costing, I'm guessing, hundreds of billions of dollars, collectively today probably over $1 trillion. And every White House administration is essentially added to them in some form or another. So give us a scoop of the current facilities and bunkers and contingency plans already in place. And when you say the elite will be saved, who are the elite? Who exactly are you referring to, if you have names That would be good. And how many people are we speaking about? And give us a brief summary of who's included among this privileged elite, because it means then that all the rest of us are not considered essential enough to save. So you'd be saving an infinitesimal amount of people and sacrificing everyone else. That does not sound like a good plan. Deterrence and detente sounds like a good plan. And also, what about these hidden cities? Now, we know they exist. I've actually seen footage of them. In fact, Jesse Ventura, who appeared on this program a couple years ago, had gone to one and got somewhat into it before he was stopped. So we never talk about it. The media never talks about it, as if it's been told, don't touch the story, so it doesn't. So I'm sure you're aware of where these facilities are, how big they are, how extensive they are, what can a person reasonably expect to find in them. So give us that whole picture now, please.
Sure. So the name of the book, the title of the book, is Raven Rock, and that is the name of the primary mountain bunker in Pennsylvania, just over the Pennsylvania border from Maryland, near Camp David, that would serve as the alternate relocation facility for the Pentagon. And it's where, in the event of a threat or a catastrophic attack on Washington, the senior U.S. military officials would evacuate. Raven Rock has served as the centerpiece of what's known as the relocation arc for about 60, 70 years now. It was built in the late 1940s and early 1950s and has been updated and expanded since 9/11 to hold nearly a million square feet of office space, room for about 5,000 people in the event of an attack or a threat on Washington. And it would serve as just one of a stunningly large number of these bunkers hidden around Washington. At its peak during the Cold War, there were about 100 of them scattered across Pennsylvania, Maryland, Virginia, West Virginia, and even down into North Carolina, both mountain bunkers and then sort of above-ground relocation facilities. There was a bunker at the Greenbrier Resort, which would have held Congress. The senators and congressmen would have been evacuated to a bunker there. Mount Weather, which is a bunker about 80 minutes west of Washington in the Bluemont, in the Catoctin Mountains outside Bluemont, Virginia. And Mount Weather is the main FEMA facility, FEMA being the civilian agency that's in charge of running the civilian side of these so-called continuity of government programs. And Mount Weather, again, still in existence today, still being updated and expanded in the wake of 9/11. And then beyond that, there are all sorts of other bunkers around the country. There is the NORAD command bunker in Colorado Springs, which some of your listeners, I'm sure, are familiar with from the Matthew Broderick movie War Games in the 1980s, a very famous bunker out there. But then there are a lot of lesser-known facilities as well. The Supreme Court, for a period, would have been evacuated to a mountain resort in Asheville, North Carolina, the Grove Park Inn, where they would have set up the Supreme Court in one of the reception halls at the resort. And then the Federal Reserve, for instance, set up a bunker in Mount Pony, Virginia, where its leadership would be evacuated, as well as secret vaults that held more than $2 billion in cash that was meant to help restart the U.S. economy after a devastating attack. Now, one of the sort of the funny details that part of this, what I found so interesting about researching this book and putting together the details of this book, is the extent to which there are sort of darkly funny moments hidden in all of this planning. And the Federal Reserve bunker for me was one of those. So in the 1970s, when the U.S. public rejected on a day-to-day basis using the $2 bill, well, the U.S. government had, you know, hundreds of thousands of them, millions of them, in fact, lying around and they packaged them all up and hid them away in the Mount Pony bunker so that after nuclear Armageddon, effectively, we would all be relying on $2 bills to conduct most of our currency exchanges. And then there were just dozens and scores of these other facilities around the country. The FEMA set up regional command posts and regional bunkers in places like Maynard, Massachusetts, and Denton, Texas, 8 of them, some total, around the country, that would effectively become the regional government headquarters for the United States, with the idea that it would actually be relatively hard after a major attack to deal with tackling the entire United States governments at once. And so we would sort of break it down into 8 regional governments around the country. So these facilities, many of them, again, still exist today. There are still people sitting in many of these bunkers 24 hours a day, 365 days a week. For the most part, they're relatively skeleton crews, but could be staffed up very, very quickly. And to do that and to sort of figure out the rising level of threat, many of your listeners, I'm sure, will be familiar with the DEFCON system, the Defense Readiness System, DEFCON 5 down to DEFCON 1 from movies or TV shows. But little known is that the United States now has a COGCON system also, a Continuity of Government Condition ranking that goes from COGCON 4, which is normal peacetime operation, down to COGCON 1, which shows that all U.S. facilities would be fully staffed with the designated successors and designated survivors who would run the government after some sort of massive attack. Now, part of what is interesting and scary about understanding some of this nuclear war planning is, as you alluded to, that, you know, the vast majority of the United States would be destroyed in any large scale nuclear exchange with a country like Russia. But even under the worst case scenarios, part of what is troubling is understanding just how many people would survive the initial attack. Under modern estimates, as many as 100 million Americans might actually survive even a large scale nuclear event with Russia. And so the government's plans were really focused on trying to ensure that population was able to have some type of government and some type of safety and security in the event of a national disaster. Part of what is so challenging about so many of these plans is, you know, they look so neat and clean and well organized on paper as the government drafted them and thought about them over years and years. But it turns out when you get into it, you know, very few of these plans seem like they would have worked very well in practice. Now, each government agency did have its own system or its own responsibilities for a post-attack environment, you know, sort of what it would be responsible for after a nuclear attack on the country. And in many ways, they were sort of relatively closely aligned with the peacetime operation, but not in everything. So, for instance, the post office would have actually been the agency that was in charge of registering the dead and figuring out who was still alive. And the thinking was that the post office is the government agency that best knows where people live. The National Park Service would be the agency that was in charge of running the refugee camps, because the thinking was that the national parks would be largely untouched by a nuclear exchange, at least in the short term. You're absolutely right that there are all sorts of challenges related to nuclear winter that would have become very pressing very quickly in a lot of these exchanges. The U.S. Department of Agriculture would have been the agency that would have been in charge of feeding the population that survived. And they developed in the 1950s a special type of cracker known as a survival biscuit. So it's basically a particularly nutritious but poor-tasting graham cracker that was manufactured in mass quantities and hidden away in fallout shelters to serve as the food for people after doomsday. And each of these agencies, part of what is interesting about tracing these plans through is these plans still exist today. And so they have been updated to look at new types of threats and to address new types of problems. So the post office isn't necessarily still responsible for sending postcards to all of your surviving family relatives in the event of a nuclear attack, but it is the agency responsible for distributing medical countermeasures in the event of a pandemic or biological or chemical attack on the country. So your friendly neighborhood postman or postwoman might be one day showing up at your door with an Ebola vaccine.
Also, largely the measure taken by the U.S. government to protect the higher political elite and military brass, such as underground installations and facilities you've been mentioning, these bunkers and infrastructures necessary to save their lives, are constructed by private firms and contractors of the military-industrial complex. So there are likely private investors involved in the equation, also in the corporate and financial elite, with deep ties with the government. So to what degree could you imagine that the corporate elite be gathered and protected in the event of a nuclear attack, and who decides who is to be saved and who will perish?
It's a great question, and it's one that the answer would really surprise a lot of people, where, as you say, there are certain high-level government officials who would be saved as part of these plans. I mean, sort of effectively the people that you would generally think of, cabinet officials, congressional leaders, senior department and agency leaders. But then there are a large component in a lot of these programs of private sector companies. AT&T was very, very closely integrated into these plans over the course of the Cold War, because they ran so many of the communication networks that were responsible for post-attack nuclear communications. And under modern times, there are, again, you know, various communication companies and various other private sector companies that continue to be involved in these plans up until the present day. But then there's also a level of these plans, both in the past and in present day, that were never really public at the time. So during the Eisenhower administration, for instance, he actually appointed eight men, largely private citizens, largely business leaders, who were pre-selected to be powerful wartime czars in the event of a national emergency, and would step in and after the government nationalized, you know, all of the housing, all of the transportation, all of the manufacturing, all of the economy, effectively, these men would step in and run various sectors of the U.S. economy carte blanche. And we didn't know at the time that these appointments existed at all, or that any of these plans or contingency procedures existed. And so one of the questions I think that is worth asking today is, are there similar plans for today? Is there a chance that there are private citizens who have been pre-designated with wartime positions in the event of an attack on the United States?
You state that dying in a widespread nuclear confrontation might be better than surviving if given all the other conditions that would be implemented. For example, in addition to doomsday preparations to save America's top officials, the survival plans include many other elements that are contrary to our democracy and our Constitution in particular. For example, an emergency government would be put into place that would immediately turn into rule by martial and military law. All private industry would fall under the control of the government. Many have spoken of the shadow government or a deep state, but this would be the visible governance by a shadow government that is already in place but not in the public eye. So deal with that, and then a subsequent question will be, are you familiar with these underground cities?
So you are absolutely right that I think sort of part of the challenge of understanding these plans today is just how little we understand about who these figures are, who would be running the United States in the event of a national catastrophe, or particularly even if something happened in Washington. I mean, one of the challenges in this continuity planning that has been very evident to people involved in it since the 1990s is that with the rise of terrorism and with rogue states like North Korea, you increasingly face a challenge where the United States might be largely untouched, but that an attack would hit Washington and knock out Washington, leaving the rest of us leaderless. And so to the extent that we face any real concern as a nation in the event that something happens to that, it would be nice to know who we should be turning to for control. As for the underground cities, these facilities at Raven Rock, at Mount Weather, at NORAD, I mean, are massive underground facilities. I mean, they are freestanding buildings inside of mountains. And as I said, each one would hold between 3,000 and 5,000 people, perhaps even more when you factor in some of the facilities related to them close by. And they contain everything that you would expect to find in a city. I mean, there are, there are fire departments, there are police departments, barber shops, dining facilities, medical facilities, and everything that you would need to run a nuclear war for, perhaps even months at a time.
Just one more question here. Here's what I find especially disturbing. If there's a privileged elite who have it within their means to be saved and the entire remainder of humanity is simply collateral damage, then what faith and trust can we have in the decision-making of our highest political military leaders? Right now, the U.S. is backing out of the international nuclear treaties. There's little respect being shown for the wisdom of our past leaders to prevent a nuclear confrontation at any cost. And Trump and his rogues even consider first strike capabilities. Hillary Clinton is a big first strike believer. And billions are being spent to upgrade our entire nuclear weapon arsenal and delivery capabilities. And if this is underpinning of what America has become, then what is it really?
I think that these are real and challenging questions that we should be wrestling with in a democracy. We have very little understanding today of the acts that our government would take in our name in the event of a major catastrophe. And in many ways, by many measurements, we are closer today to nuclear war and the possibility of nuclear war than we have been in a quarter century. The news out of North Korea on a near weekly basis is threatening, and Russia is newly aggressive on the national and international stage in a way that we haven't seen in a quarter century. I think that there are real problems here, and that they deserve more of a debate and more of a discussion.
A lot more, especially since we have 15,000 nuclear weapons in the world waiting to be launched. And now, because this new arms race, other non-nuclear nations like Japan want to join in, as does Saudi Arabia, and Trump could actually oblige them, and especially if we would be getting private industry to build them for them. He's only looking at it as would they, of how much money can we make off this, not what happens if the number one sponsor of terrorism in the Middle East, Saudi Arabia, is given the opportunity to have nuclear weapons. How long would it be then before terrorists had those nuclear weapons? That's really concerning me. And yet we're posturing with tensions with North Korea, and the nuclear arms race with Russia is escalating, and we still have lots of anti-Russian war hawks in our defense and intelligence departments, either want to engage directly or indirectly with Putin. So in your personal estimation and evaluation, how concerned should we be about a future exchange of nuclear weapons, and where do you see the tensions most high and volatile?
I think both North Korea and Russia are real challenges. Lost among a lot of these headlines today are some rising tensions also between India and Pakistan, which are both nuclear-armed nations with a long history of antagonism between them. And again, that's an area that we haven't been focused on for you know, perhaps even 20 years, and is definitely heating up and something that we should be increasingly concerned about.
I would agree with that. Garrett, thank you very much for all your good work. Garrett's the author of Raven Rock, the story of the U.S. government's secret plan to save itself while the rest of us die. The website is garrettgraff.com. Appreciate you being on today, Garrett.
My pleasure. Have a great day.
I'm Gary Noll. We're going to take a break and come right back with our next guest. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome all of you from all over the world who are listening in right now. We are continuing with part two of our Conversations with Remarkable Minds series on our Progressive Commentary Hour. We're going to talk about why there is no unified progressive movement and what is necessary to build one. Oh, we have a lot of progressives. As I read some statistics on how many people have come to the Progressive Radio Network, we had 253 million visits in the last 12 months. Over 54 million people have downloaded this program, 10 million from just one of 16 servers every month. So there's no shortage of people interested in the kind of voices that you would not hear in the mainstream, or for that matter, on many of the other so-called liberal stations, because frequently they are following the dictates of the corporate liberal community with the Clinton agenda, which is not progressive. So now we have an election. We have, between the Republicans and the Democrats, more or less about 125 to 26 million people who vote. But more people do not vote. We have about 22% registered Republicans. We have about 28% Democrats, but we have over 41 independents. So on this program, we try to present people who will at least give you positive solutions to correcting many of these issues. And we had on Jill Stein, as we had on Rocky Anderson and Ralph Nader, people who on every single issue would have said and did say yes. For example, we gave 35 questions to each of the people who came on the air. Would you close down the military bases around the world, over 800? Yes. Would you have universal health care? Yes. Would you take the military-industrial complex down by at least 50 to 80% and then reuse that money on more essential programs like de-ghettoizing America, essential infrastructure? Yes. Would you label genetically engineered food? Yes. And would you take the profit out of medicine? Yes. And yet, the very people who would help solve our problems, bring us to a world of diplomacy, détente, and possible peace, who would, let's say, bring down the tempers and let reasoned minds of men and women who have a history of living in peace with other people and are good negotiators of that peace be our diplomats. They were all rejected. Under 1 million people voted for Jill Stein. That's under 1%. And she had a lot of publicity. Granted, she was in the debates, but she had an enormous amount of media. So why? Why do we not have a viable group of people working together for common goals that can help save the planet, de-escalate military tensions, reestablish a respect for all life, the sacredness of life? Why? To help us resolve this, we've invited Rabbi Michael Lerner, clearly one of the nation's greatest Jewish intellectuals and spiritual political activists. As a teenager, Rabbi Lerner was a student of Abraham Heschel, a great socially responsible mystical thinker who marched with Martin Luther King. And during the 60s, he was a chair of the Berkeley chapter of the Students for Democratic Society, among the also the Seattle Seven, and while teaching at the University of Washington. And he's the editor of Tycoon Magazine, an award-winning journal of interfaith and progressive critiques on American culture and politics and religion. And he is the founder of the Interfaith Humanistic Organization, the Network for Spiritual Progressives, which offers training in spiritual activism. And his websites are tikkun.org and spiritualprogressives.org. Nice to have you with us today.
Hi, Gary. Glad to be with you.
Thank you. Michael, I've been inviting guests to the program during the past several weeks to speak about different aspects of the progressive movement in America. And for those who have become completely disenchanted with our duopoly in Washington, the choice of presidential candidates, our obscene military complex, the conflicts overseas, and the overall direction our nation and culture are heading, and there seems to be a lack of truly viable, unified alternatives. Bernie Sanders has started such a movement, but his efforts at reform within the current system, and the Democratic Party in particular, can be seen as a divisive movement. But his efforts at reform will not work as long as he is held accountable to the Democratic corporate standards. And on some issues, he is more progressive. On his foreign policy, he is no different than the neoliberals. So the common word on the street among many is that this little difference between the two parties, and rather than reform one or the other, what is really needed is altogether a different alternative. And my question begins with, why is it so difficult for a realistic progressive alternative movement, which espouses higher ethics and morals based upon universal principles of dignity and compassion, to emerge? Mm-hmm. Your thoughts?
Yes. Well, let's start with this, what I'm about to tell you comes from research that I did as the executive director of the Institute for Labor and Mental Health, that in which I had groups and individuals working with individuals with thousands of middle-income working people, and my focus was on the question: what is it that leads people to vote against their own economic self-interest? And why is it that they are not, why is it that they who voted previously in, let's say, the 1940s and 50s and 60s for liberal or progressive candidates to now be voting for conservative or reactionary candidates? And what I learned was this, that people, by and large, do not vote primarily or at least solely on the issues, the economic issues, the political issues, and all of that. They often vote on, and their attitudes towards politics is shaped by who they feel understands them and cares about them. And here we get into the central problem that has happened for the liberal and progressive forces, because in the 1960s, the liberal and progressive forces were able to pass legislation that that ended segregation, that gave voting rights, that allowed the appointment of liberals to the Supreme Court, achieved rights for women, and in many dimensions extended the rights of human beings. Now, that has gone away over the course of the past 50 years. Why? And what I learned from people was because they have come to believe that liberals and progressives have contempt for them, can't stand them. You cannot build a movement. You cannot lead people unless you love people. You can't move people to understand what's right about your politics when simultaneously you are giving off the sense that you have contempt for them and their lives, or that at least you have no understanding of their lives. And this is true both in the Democratic Party and in the forces around Bernie and the forces that are to the left of Bernie, that all of them have not paid attention to the consequences of of the shaming and blaming that people put forward towards all of those who are not yet part of our movement. The way that we talk about them as, for example, thinking that all white people have privileges regardless of their economic and political circumstances, that all men are privileged, and that consequently the oppression of people of color and the oppression of women is something that all people who are not women, or all people who are not all people who are not peoples of color, have to bear responsibility for and can be blamed for, leads people to feel like, hey, these people have no understanding of what my life is like. And that's what I heard over thousands and thousands of people telling me. And these were not people who were upper crust. These were not people who were in the top 20% of income. These were people who were members of labor unions. These were people who were working very sometimes two and three jobs. And they told me, hey, I hear when you talk, Rabbi Lerner, when the Network of Spiritual Progressives talks, when Tikkun talks, I hear a language of compassion. But when I go into any political movement, I hear people telling me that I'm privileged when I'm not privileged, when my actual life is I'm working two or three jobs, or my life is that I've struggled tremendously to get to where I am right now. I grew up in poverty, or I grew up in conditions in which the poor people in my community were looked down upon, or whatever. The details of, I mean, are differ from person to person. But the what shared thing that the right was able to do was to turn to people and say, you know, those liberals are elitists. They hate you. They have no contempt for you. They think that you are all privileged. They think that you are all racist. They think that you are all sexist. They think that you are all homophobes. Now, look, I totally recognize that a section of the people who voted for Trump were really racist, were really sexist, were really homophobes. But there's a large section of people who have moved from the liberal and progressive world, or voting for liberal and progressive candidates, to the right, despite their disagreement with the right on many other issues, because they feel this contempt that comes to them from the liberal and progressive world, and no real understanding of the class issues that they face and other kinds of oppression that they face in their lives. So instead of a liberal and progressive movement trying to help people recognize all the ways in which the class structure and the economic and political and social arrangements of our society actually lead to the pain that they're in their personal lives, the way in which the ethos of capitalism, with its ethos of looking out for number one, materialism, selfishness, not trusting other people, maximize your own money at the highest level possible, all of those values that are endemic to capitalism, instead of telling people, look, this is why it's so hard to maintain a loving relationship, this is what's undermining loving relationships, instead, the liberal and progressive forces ignore that suffering, and the right comes forward and says, you know where that suffering comes from? It comes from all the special interests who are getting favored by the government while you are being ignored. That's baloney. That's a crazy analysis. But it speaks to a feeling that people have that nobody really cares about them on the left, that they're only – that if they're not part of the left, they're perceived as being racist, sexist, homophobes, Islamophobes, et cetera. And so they begin to feel like, well, I don't care. I don't care how badly – I don't care even if they cut into my economic well-being. I'm going to support them and vote for them because they understand my life, whereas these people in the liberal left think that I'm a privileged being who's got all kinds of wonderful things going for me, and they actually have contempt for me. So it's that issue, that that psycho-spiritual level, the psychological pain that people have at being blamed. You see, just one last thing to say before I finish this analysis. The ethos of capitalism puts forward the following worldview, The reason why there's vast inequalities in the society is because it is a meritocracy, and those who make it have merit and worked hard and deserve to make it, while those who are suffering have nobody to blame but themselves. This ethos has been accepted in the liberal and progressive world unconsciously, but nevertheless really, so that when you hear so many people in the liberal and progressive world and also in the liberal section of the spiritual world saying, hey, you created your own reality, and you can create any reality you want. This is underlying the ethos of a lot of liberal psychotherapists, a lot of liberal spiritual movement, and a lot of the thought in the rest of the liberal and progressive world. You create your own reality, and you can get out of it if you just take charge of it. No understanding of the class realities that make it so very, very hard for people, most people, to move up the class ladder, either economically or how that plays out in personal life. So what people end up feeling is most people end up feeling terrible about themselves because they blame themselves for a reality that isn't really their fault, that they've inherited and that they have very little opportunity to change. Now along come the liberal and progressive forces, and instead of saying to people, you know, you're not to blame, that it's not your fault that you're in suffering and pain. You're actually victims of a crazy system whose values are destructive of the planet and destructive of your lives. Instead, they hear from the liberal and progressive world, not only are you to blame for where you are in your life, you're also to blame for all the suffering of people of color. You're to blame for all the suffering of women. You're to blame for... So, in other words, we reinforce the self-blame instead of undermine it and help people overcome it. And that dynamic will keep, no matter whether you're in the Democratic Party or outside the Democratic Party, whether you're to the left of the Democratic Party or whether you're in Bernie's movement or to the left of it, until this level of consciousness seeps into the left is will continue to be self-defeating.
Michael, I appreciate that insight. I want to parse one piece of what you said to take it a little further. When you and I were growing up, liberal meant a lot different things than it does today, and there was a different type of persona around those who espoused liberal values and how we approached issues. There is a phenomenon I'm seeing today. I'm still formulating how it fits, but here's the overview. Today we have 10.2 million millionaires. We have 16.8 million professional people, lawyers, doctors, engineers, accountants, CPAs, architects, professors. One group has about 4 members per family. That's your millionaire class. The other has about the same. Now, you're talking then about children. So let's just say that you have 2 children. That's 20 million young people who are growing up with all the advantages and never having to question any of the deeper social inequality. These are the people that can go to NYU and spend $72,000 on tuition, not including room and board, and never worry about debt because it's paid cash. They don't have to worry about an apartment, sharing it with 3 other people. They get their own in a nice environment. There's a restaurant now in Manhattan on the Upper West Side that charges $55 for a beer because it's some kind of heirloom beer or made locally. And these people go in at night. I've been there at 11 o'clock at night. It's near where I live, and I just am curious. I walk in. It's packed with young people, millennials, 4, 5, 6 beers on a table. Well, who can afford to go out and spend $300, $400 on beer in an evening? And that's just for the beer, and that's just without the food. And then you have the professional class. The professional class only makes between $75,000 to $400,000. Some will make $500,000 a year. But their kids were raised, went to school with the other millionaires' kids. They're frequently friends. They live as if their parents are millionaires. In the process, their parents rack up enormous debt, though the kids are excluded from many responsibilities. They're out partying. They're living. They're frequently highly educated. Both groups are highly educated. And now they go in and gentrify a neighborhood. Whoever was there before, people of color, African Americans or Latinos, whoever, they're gone. Do they care about who lived here before what the neighbor was like? No. They just care now that they got an inside deal on a good place out in, you know, in Brooklyn or in Manhattan. And so we have a whole generation of people being raised disconnected from the spiritual values that would honor the other. They're not out there making it a better world, though they may intellectually believe that they can do that. Everything's about themselves and their comforts and their possessions or what they're achieving. But they don't look at, can they help anyone else in the process? Can they change the environment that others are in so that those circumstances you just mentioned aren't as enforceable? And the answer is, with some exception, no, they're not. So these are the people who are Bernie supporters, many of them. These are the people who are the corporate Democrats or the people who have not understood what it is to be one of those people who are struggling 2 to 3 jobs and then told that they're deplorable. And they think, how am I deplorable? My family grew up in a coal town. I've worked my whole life. My family's worked their whole life. We have bare minimums. We suffer. We're in debt. How am I responsible for someone else's life being? I can't be responsible for that, and yet no one gives them a form. And then you have identity politics, which I'm terribly against. Boy, is that going to isolate people. And yet that's what we focus on, because that's, the news says, if it bleeds, it leads. And so they get the attention. And as a result, we then begin to believe that, you know, it's your fault for someone else's suffering, whether you had any responsibility for it or not. Could you take us where we need to go now to understand putting these pieces together? And it's class. We have an enormous class problem in our society, and we're not facing it. Your thoughts?
You're entirely right, and that's just another translation of what I was just saying. Yes, you're completely. We're on the same wavelength, completely on this. And you see. It's not that I'm against people having an identity and affirming their identity and affirming the forms of oppression that they experience in that identity. I'm a rabbi. I'm also a psychotherapist. I'm also the editor of Tikkun magazine. And in those capacities, I affirm very much the Jewish identity, and but I don't affirm it as something that puts me in the position of telling everybody else how bad they are because they're Christian and they've been and have oppressed us for the past 2,000 years, us Jews. I don't focus on the ways in which Jews are not white people. They've been, in fact, the primary victims of white people in Europe for at least the last 1,800 years. So instead, I use the suffering and oppression of Jews to help me understand and identify with the suffering of other groups. But what's happened is that the form of identity politics that has emerged in the liberal and progressive world today is a form that leads people to shame and blame those who are not part of that group and say, you did this to me. If you're white, if you're a male, if you're whatever, you are the reason why I am suffering. So instead of developing a form of identity that helps us identify with the suffering of other people and their oppressions, it leads to a discourse in which people self-righteously point to their suffering and then blame other people for that suffering, rather than understand the system that has created that, a system that most men and most white people did not create. We were born into it. We inherited it. You know, sometimes I say, I'm so sorry I was born with a penis. I didn't mean to oppress you. You know, I'm so sorry that I was born with white skin. I can't help it. But I didn't create this reality. And if I have some benefits from it, I also have many disbenefits from it. And one of the things about the whole discourse of privilege is that it's based on the notion that the only real privilege is economic. And that's another big problem in liberal and progressive thought, that it's so economistic. It thinks that what really counts is how much money you have. But I believe that the thing that gives the greatest privilege in life is the ability to love and love others, that this is what's the most valuable thing, not the most money, but the most love. And in that case, then I want to say those women who get to raise children have an incredible privilege. I wish I had that privilege. I wish I could give birth. You know, it's a beautiful thing to be able to have the first few years of life of a child, to be able to be with that child and give them the kind of nurturing that only a mother can give through her body directly. So that leads me to say, let's rethink the whole notion of privilege, because it's not the privilege of having lots of money. It's also the privilege that leads to the kinds of psychological distortions that we see coming at us from Trump and others like him, who are, I don't care how much power he has, he is a deeply distorted human being who hurts people and who hurts himself. And that's, for me, is not a privilege. It's a deficit, no matter how much political power, how much economic power. That man has unbelievable suffering and unbelievable pain in his life that leads to the craziness that he manifests. And so, too, with many other people in those positions of economic privilege. We have to rethink what privilege is by saying, from a liberal and progressive standpoint, what values do we think are really valuable? Is it how much money you have? I say no. It's how much love, how much kindness, how much generosity, how much how much we can have an identification with the well-being of the planet, and how much we can see every human being as an embodiment of the sacred. That's the privilege, the most important privilege in life, is to have that kind of consciousness. So, yeah, I think many of us are privileged in the liberal and progressive world, regardless of our economic status. I mean, I'm living on Social Security. It's no other income, okay, no matter the fact that I'm the editor of Tikkun. We don't have enough money in Tikkun to pay me a salary. Okay, so I don't have very much money, but I have this incredible privilege of being able to love and being able to see the loving consciousness in other human beings and affirm that. And that, I think, is an incredible privilege, and it's not because of I'm white or because I'm male. It's actually something that many people of color have, and many people, women have. In fact, many women, more than men, often have that. That's an incredible privilege that women have, to be able to see how important loving and caring and kindness and compassion and empathy are.
Well, Michael, you just you addressed one other issue I had just now. Because one of our great national essayists, Lewis Lapham, recently defined our new era as the age of folly, a realization we take home from this recent election between Trump and Clinton, is that as long as people remain immersed in the idea of their beliefs and fears can't be changed, and that they are determined to not change them, then ignorance will always remain a choice. And this election proved that more and more people are choosing ignorance as their guide instead of reason and intuition, and you've given us insights now as to why people resist changing their minds and beliefs, and particularly when they support that which is unquestionably in their worst interest and prefer to choose ignorance over moral truths that you just discussed. So thank you for being on and sharing these. You've given a lot of clarity to a very complex issue.
Thank you. Well, just one thing that I want to mention is that we at the Network of Spiritual Progressives, that's spiritualprogressives.org, are offering a training for activists, particularly activists who want to make an impact both in changing the ethos and consciousness on the left, which is the prerequisite for changing the consciousness of people on the right, but to do both, first to learn how to change the left and then to change the right. We're doing that. We have that, and that training is online and available to people all over the country, and you can learn about it and sign up for it or at least sign up for more information about when the next time it's being given at spiritualprogressives.org.
Michael, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me. Bye-bye. God bless.
Okay. And that is a continuation of our series of conversations with Michael Mime with Rabbi Michael Lerner. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more on our next program. Have a nice day.